podcast component of ArmageddonLetters.com, a virtual time machine back to the moment when the world was nearly destroyed in late October 1962. You can also follow us on Twitter at ArmageddonTweet. I'm Jim Blight.
And I'm Janet Lang. The Cuban Missile Crisis happened a half a century ago, and it was our closest brush with nuclear war. We want to give you some of the backstory that led to this horrible situation that nearly blew up the world. And what we're going to do now is take you back to the moment when Kennedy is shaken, really, from the sleepwalk that he's been in with regard to what's going on in Cuba all through 1961 and into part of 1962. At this point, the Soviet government, Nikita Khrushchev, and his many colleagues have been issuing many, many denials that they would do anything as foolish as put nuclear weapons in Cuba. In fact, they've said they don't even need to have Soviet bases there, that the Soviet Union is so powerful that they can obliterate the U.S., if it came to that, from the Soviet Union. And Kennedy has believed this, or at least he's hoped that this is true. What happens now is that on October 16th, he finds out his hope is dashed.
Yeah, it's been wishful thinking, the wish being the father of the thought. But it's clashed now. It's collided with the facts as they're represented to Kennedy by his intelligence people. So we go to, let's start at October 15th, a few hours before. Mac Bundy, George Bundy, the National Security Advisor, is having a dinner party at his home for the departing ambassador to France, Charles Chip Bolin, also a Soviet specialist, but he and his wife are about to get on a boat and go to France where he would become ambassador in Paris. Mac Bundy gets a call from the National Photographic Intelligence Corps, the NPIC, that the this is how Ray Klein, the deputy director of CIA, put it to Bundy. The things we've been worried about, the things we think are there. And Bundy says, thank you. Kennedy is in New York State at the time, speaking on behalf of New York congressional candidates for the midterm elections. Bundy, of course, has the option to call him wherever he is, but he decides that Kennedy is not going to, there's no way he can get back to Washington until the wee hours of the morning. And to give him this news in the middle of the night makes no sense. There won't be anybody to discuss it with and so forth. So he decides famously now to give the president an opportunity to get the last decent night's sleep he's going to have for quite a while. He goes in the next morning around 8 o'clock, presents the evidence to Kennedy. Kennedy puts down the Post, the Times, the Wall Street Journal, everything that he reads daily. Says to Bundy, well, they talk for a few minutes about who should be involved in the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, now called the XCOM. And they schedule a meeting. Everybody is to drop everything they're doing. Everybody is to also go under the radar and show up as inobtrusively as possible at the White House at 11:30 a.m. The meeting starts with Kennedy coming in and saying to his intelligence corps, with all their charts and diagrams and photos taken from the U-2 over Cuba, Kennedy says, okay, let's go. He then gets a briefing showing lots of pictures and so forth, and you feel for Kennedy here because he's being told by Bundy in the morning of that day that there are nuclear missile sites in Cuba being erected, which are analogous or possibly identical to the, exactly the same kind of medium and intermediate range ballistic missiles in Siberia. And the only presumed cause, presumed purpose of such missiles will be to target them on American cities.
Now remember, while Kennedy has been believing Khrushchev's denials, his critics haven't. He's had very, very strong criticisms from Congress, from the Republicans in Congress, and from Democrats. Right. Well, so there's a range of hawks across the Democratic and Republican Party who have been saying for months, at least since August, attack Cuba, attack Cuba, attack Cuba. And Kennedy has been holding them off. Basically, I'm sure that as he was hearing this information first from Bundy, part of him is immediately reacting in a couple ways. One is he's angry that he's been lied to, and secondly, he can just hear a chorus of political critics yelling, I told you so, I told you so,
that's
I told
right.
you so.
Soft on Cuba, soft on communism.
So clearly his first reactions are emotional.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good way to state it. He's really angry, certainly at Khrushchev, at the critics, and probably at himself for believing the lies of Khrushchev. And remember, in September, Kennedy was so sure that Khrushchev would never put missiles in Cuba. I mean, Khrushchev had never put missiles outside of the Soviet Union, never mind this close to the U.S. Kennedy was so sure that it would never happen that he issued a public statement that said, don't do this, Mr. Khrushchev, that if you do, quote, the gravest possibilities, consequences will arise.
Mm.
So this is the context within which Kennedy is hearing this information. He's had now a couple of hours to sort of digest it, and then he goes into this first morning meeting of the XCOM on October 16th, 1962.
Yeah, although I don't know about the digestion. I think he probably had indigestion for the next few weeks. We have now the Kennedy tapes. They're in reasonably complete form now, or as complete as they'll ever be. As we know, Kennedy decided for reasons of his own to have the Army Corps of Engineers put a tape recorder underneath the table at which many of these XCOM meetings took place, and he operated it with an on-off switch that he triggered with his knee. We know that Robert Kennedy knew about it. We think probably no one else in the room did know about it, that the conversations were being taped. Kennedy was always conscious as president on what his legacy would be. That's why he hired people like Ted Sorensen and Arthur Schlesinger, brilliant literary figures in their own right, to assist him in the White House so that when it came time for John F. Kennedy, the former president, now retired, to write his memoirs, he wanted good people working with him, but he also wanted the data. He wanted to know exactly what went on when he was discussing things with his aides. So now to get right to the heart of the matter here, in the Kennedy tapes, 11:30 a.m., probably by 11:50 a.m. now, this is Kennedy speaking to a variety of people from the CIA, Arthur Lundahl, Sidney Graybeal, so forth, who are experts on Soviet missiles. Kennedy says, how long have we got? These are direct quotes. How long have we got? We can't tell, can we, how long before it can be fired? No, sir. That depends on how ready the ground support is for the missile. And then Kennedy goes into this very close interrogation about how do you know it's a missile? How do you know that's the right ground? You can sort of sense in a way that he's trying to argue these guys out of the conclusion they've already reached, because this is a horrible mess that he's in politically. He just, oh my God, what am I going to do?
In 1961, he got some bad CIA estimates regarding the Bay of Pigs. So Kennedy is very critical when he gets information from the CIA, but his critical capacities are enhanced because he really wants the information to be different. So he's badgering people. Are you sure? Are you sure? And they keep saying, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, they're sure. Actually, Robert Kennedy had gone over to the NPIC, to the photographic lab, and had the same basic reaction before the meeting, which was, are you sure? Robert and Jack, I mean, normal people, even in the government, had no idea how do you put all this stuff together and come out with the conclusion that the Soviets are putting missile sites in. Now, the tendency here in this meeting is to go very fast toward an attack on Cuba because it is so damaging, so embarrassing, and so dangerous. What Kennedy is trying to figure out here is how long do we have to decide before the missiles become operational. Operational means they're ready to fire, but it also means that the warheads, the nuclear warheads, are somehow identified and they can figure out how far away from the launchers they are, how long it'll take to get them there, set it all up, and so on. And Kennedy is thinking at the moment, I don't have a lot of time. I think what Kennedy is thinking is I have not weeks, not days, but hours on this first go at it. And Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, steps in and in a way tries to check this rush toward military action. And he does it in a classic McNamara way by referring to the oddest conceivable kind of facts that no one else has noticed. So what McNamara does, he says, Mr. President, there's no fence around these missile sites. And nobody knows where McNamara is going with this, no fence. So what, there's no fence? Because I think they would at least put up a barbed wire fence around a missile site that they were actually thinking of using, that is operational, that has warheads nearby or possibly even already within the site. And since they don't have a fence there, frankly, sir, he says, we do not believe they are ready to fire. So we see that what McNamara is trying to do right at the outset is to slow this thing down. He's come up with this idea that there are no fences around the missile sites, and therefore they're not ready yet, because we know how cautious the Russians are, and God knows on the island of Cuba they sure don't want any Cubans showing up at this missile site, and so forth. So he's trying to slow it down. But let's go now to the end of the first meeting, beginning at 11:30 a.m. It ends in the early afternoon. They're trying to figure out when to meet. They decide on 6:30. Kennedy says, no, I don't want to wait that long. I want 6. So they do 6. He summarizes the meeting in this remarkably acute way. He says, we got 3 things we're dealing with here. Number 1, we go in, we take the missile sites out. We hit the missile sites. Number 2, we do a massive airstrike, over 1,000 sorties, where we just destroy every Soviet military or military-looking installation on the island, all over the island. Number 3, even more radical, we send in the Marines. After the bombing, after the target bombing and after the carpet bombing, we send in the Marines. So these are the 3 things we're going to do. And what Kennedy says just before the meeting breaks up is, well, I don't know what we're going to do, but I think I'm pretty sure we're going to do number 1. In other words, Kennedy comes out of the very first meeting thinking, we're going to bomb the missile sites in Cuba, and you get the very distinct impression that he would like to do it this afternoon or early evening.
Luckily, with the passage of even just a few hours, things begin to settle a little. Kennedy begins to think about consequences. McNamara begins talking about, if we do this, what do they do? And so forth. And so you get a more complex discussion in the next meeting of the XCOM later in that evening. And then what you have is, as a result of that, basically Kennedy's alter ego, Ted Sorensen, drafts a memo for Kennedy on October 17th that sort of puts all of this together. And in a way, it perfectly lays out the dilemma that Kennedy is facing. Not sort of the quick action of his first immediate reactions, but a more deliberate description of the difficulties that lie ahead. So the first part of the memo is easy. It says, well, what we want to do is get the missiles out. So that's their policy objective, if you will.
And there's no discussion of that.
No.
There's no discussion of it. It's interesting because some people think there should have been.
Yeah.
Adlai Stevenson, the UN ambassador, thought there should be some discussion.
But he's not at that meeting.
Even if he was, he would have lost that argument.
That's true. There is a total consensus, in fact, unanimity, really, that the missiles have to come out. So that's their objective. Now, the tough part is, how do they reach their objective without incurring a high risk of war, maybe nuclear war? And Sorensen lists the challenges that they have there, and there are 4 that he lists. The first one is, if they do these things, whether it's option A, option B, option C, how would they prevent a counterattack on the U.S. mainland? That's their key question. Second one, if there wasn't an attack on the U.S. mainland, how would they prevent an attack in Turkey or Italy or Berlin? And Berlin's a real problem because they do not have any kind of big military presence there. It would go nuclear very quickly. That's a concern.
Just a short footnote here. Those 2 questions have no answer. It's really interesting that Ted Sorensen put those in there because you cannot protect the U.S. mainland, and you cannot keep the Soviets 3 million strong from attacking Berlin where you have 12,000 troops. You can't do it. You can threaten to retaliate in a massive way, but you really have no way of protecting your people. That's what's new, and Kennedy gets this.
Yeah. The third thing is, well, if they can't prevent either an attack on the U.S. mainland or an attack in Turkey or Italy or Berlin, as Jim said, good heavens, what are they going to do in response? What are their options there, and how risky are those? Final question that Sorensen puts to Kennedy in this memo is, would Castro risk total destruction by trying to attack the U.S. mainland with planes?
Interesting idea. The answer to the first part of that question we now know is yes, that the total destruction of Cuba, in fact, in Castro's mind, in the minds of the entire Cuban leadership, is a given. Once the attack begins, that Cuba has virtually no army, and so they're toast. I don't know of any evidence suggesting that Castro thought about bombing the United States. He turned that one over to Khrushchev. I mean, the few little dinky bombers that the Cubans had would make no difference whatsoever if the Soviets launched their ICBMs at American cities. This was his thinking. Why? I mean, it's really not worth thinking about.
So these are the concerns that Kennedy now is wrestling with. Basically, it's how do I reach this policy objective of getting the missiles out of Cuba without a war, and especially without a nuclear war? That's what's on his plate. That's what's coming down the pike for him. And we'll deal with some of those issues in other podcasts.
That's it for this podcast. Visit us regularly for more in the podcast series, as well as news about our new book, short films, graphic novels, and blogs by our three dynamic leaders. And don't forget to visit us at facebook.com/ArmageddonLetters. I'm Jim Blight.
And I'm Janet Lang.